I'm so excited that we have Innovate Digital Solutions as a sponsor of TCAST this season. Innovate Digital Solutions provides anything that an office might need, hardware, software, IT, copy machines, things like that. They make an office run more smooth, and they're really good at it. But one of the things that I love about Innovate, their founders, Andre and Katia Brasso, they're people that don't just believe it's important to build a strong business, but also to take that success and build a strong community around them. They really have a heart for what HeChanged It is doing. People they love have gone through some of the stuff that we talk about on this show. Andre and Katia both believe that you can build a life worth living, and there are these evidence-based solutions that can help build that life. We're so excited to be in partnership with Innovate Digital Solutions, and HeChanged It is better for it, and we hope you will be too. Go to innovate.ca and check them out. Welcome to HeCast, the official podcast of HeChanged It. As always, I am Mike Chisholm. As always, I'm excited to be here to talk to people about the idea of men's mental wellness, to listen to some stories, anecdotes, advice, ideas, experiences, all of that crap. It's great to do this. It's so fun shooting this new season. You know, we've had a little bit of time off between season one and season two. Season 110 episodes, kind of real fast and real hard and real regular. We need to take a breather while the app grew and did some things. If you haven't been to HeChangedIt.com lately, head on over. If you haven't downloaded the app, please download the HeChangedIt app and watch this thing progress. The goal, changing the world, being a place where men can go and find ways to live a better life. That's what the goal is. And the feedback that we're getting is unbelievable. And here's the fun thing about season two. We've got a lot of returning guests because, I mean, in season one, I don't know how many people have said, oh, I can't wait to come back. Can't wait to come back. Yeah, we've got that happening. So a mix of old and new. Today, Seb Lavoie is back, and I just adore Seb so much. We get to it right away. I wore my G.I. Joe shirt for him because, to me, he is a living G.I. Joe character. He really, really is. And you know, taking the experiences that he gained, the tactical operational mind that he has, both in the military and in the police, and using that to make the world a better place. Seb is just that guy. He's a hero. He's a superhero. He looks like a superhero. He's one of those guys. When you look at his Instagram, you're like, my goodness, I'm glad that humans like this exist. They inspire humans like me. And his kind, amazing, empathetic, and teaching nature is just something that I'm very, very grateful for. Seb just, he just had part of his leg amputated. He just lost his leg from the knee down a month ago. And you'd never know it when we start talking. We, of course, start talking about it. But, you know, this is a guy who has gone through many things that some people would look at as traumatic. And he just, through perspective and some of the things that he has learned, he's learned to deal with anxiety and all of these other things. If you want to think like a high on a high level and high level problem solving, if you want to gain a different perspective on what your situation might be, whatever it is, and we're not minimizing anything, but listen to a guy like Seb, and he can really help people reframe what they're going through, and that changes the trajectory of how they go through what they're going through. Seb is that guy. I appreciate him so much. We are proud to present the second appearance of Seb Lavoie. Okay, Seb, we have talked before. Obviously, you and I know your Instagram has a double C in it. And the double C stands for something that is precious to both of us. And that is old school G.I. Joe. I wore the shirt and I made sure I wore the scrap iron shirt today. And the reason I wore the scrap iron shirt, if you yourself are a living G.I. Joe character, which is one of the ways I have always envisioned you, mm-hmm. you know, you've got your armed forces and your police, you know, and who you are like that, you're that guy. If I know people in my life who are who could be a G.I. Joe, many times I do assign them. Recently, you have become a little bit more of somebody who could be a G.I. Joe because you've gone through some biological changes since the last time you were on the show.
Correct.
You lost a limb. You lost a limb, man.
Yes.
I mean, oh my God. And I hope we can maybe throw some pictures and maybe share some of the videos of your boys coming around you and rallying around you while you're in the hospital. How you doing, man? How are you still got the disposition that you have? I'm so grateful to catch up with you. Welcome back to YeeCast, Seb.
Thanks for having me back, man. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah.
And I'm doing awesome, man. I'm on the tail end of getting off the meds, and I didn't take very many, but apparently too many to not suffer withdrawals. I don't know if you remember this, but I had 9 surgeries in 2021 on the same leg. And during the 9 surgeries, there were a lot of opiates as a result of having 10 out of 10 pains and those types of things. When I stopped the opiates, there was no real plan, medically speaking. So I ended up going cold turkey, right?
Yep.
And I ended up having, you know, 9 night sweats and irritability and all kinds of withdrawal symptoms for about 17 weeks every night. And night was definitely the worst time. And this time around, I was very, very careful with how many opiates I took. I took very little. And somehow, right now, for the last probably 5 or 6 days, I've had some pretty serious withdrawals symptoms. And so a lot of irritability, a lot of nervousness, which isn't me. I'm generally very calm, very poised. And anxiety doesn't necessarily creep all that strongly in me. And I've been on the other side of this, which is, you know, really having a lot of, and I can tell because I'm shedding body weight even. And you know, and this only happens when I'm hyperactive, so to speak. And so yeah, you know, everything's going great. The recovery is going awesome. I'm probably 4 weeks ahead of schedule. I'll get in my prosthetic sometime next week, likely.
Yep. Yeah.
And everything else is going great. My training's going great. Everything is. But somehow, you know, a little on the tail end of the opiates here.
Okay. So, and I love that we can talk about this right now, because I mean, if I've met a guy who has you almost hyper aware but mindful, hyper mindful. It's you. You're that guy. You are extremely mindful. You can zoom everything and kind of get into a place. Somebody who is up on what's going on in the world. And I mean, the opioid crisis. You think about that. We hear about that. We have all known people who have either gotten onto it because of what you're talking about, off of a surgery. Formed addictive habits, things like that, because of these things. You walked into this kind of knowing that, like, you know that this could be a concern. And it's so interesting listening to somebody who is hyper aware, hyper mindful of these things, and yet, okay, I'm in it now. Mm-hmm. Holy cow, I'm actually in it. What about the poor people who aren't that aware? And how easy of a path would it be to go down that addiction path?
It is absolutely asinine that pain management is not working hand in hand with the tapering off and medical supervision of coming off the opiates. Yeah. And, you know, some countries have it and some cities have it, some hospitals do, but it's quite rare. Generally speaking, everybody's really good at pain managing. What's not so good is what do we do after? And so the instructions that say, you know, you're going to take opiates every 4 hours for a period of a week or 2 weeks. And then with no further instruction, that in itself is highly problematic. And sure. So if you are somebody that has, say, a propensity to perhaps have a bit more of an addictive personality, or if you're somebody that has, you know, facing a dark prospect in your life or those types of things, and these things are bringing you more than just pain relief, they're bringing you soul relief because they're relaxing you, they're taking the anxiety off, they're doing a whole bunch of things that a lot of people feel, you know, is interfering with their regular life. And so it's really easy to engage in them and really take them, not only because the pain is there, but at some point you start thinking, man, I sleep better. And I, you know, all of those things. And that's a very dangerous path to go down. When they sent me home the first time after the first 9 surgeries, they sent me home with about 300 pills of opiates. And I was living by myself. And I was doing all of the things by myself. And so think of it this way. Had I had an addictive personality or anything else, it's very likely that things could have went majorly pear-shaped for me. And so, and what's interesting is in the first time I was in withdrawals, I refused to sleep. It was kind of like Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, I refused to sleep because of what was happening when I was sleeping at night. And so what I would do is I would do extensive research on either YouTube and medical channels, those types of things. And I would look at the landscape in the world of opiates. First of all, we're prescribing them at a rate at about 30 times what we used to. But also, you should have seen some of the comments that I was reading, and it was heartbreaking. People saying, you know, come and help me now, I'm dying, and those types of things. And so I truly believe that that is a massive failing of the medical system in not addressing the proper tapering off of opiates. This time around, and so the first time I was on opiates for 28 days straight, and I was, you know, 0.02 milligram every 5 minutes because I was on a self-administrator.
Yeah.
But imagine this. This time I took literally 2 to 3 pills a day. That is it for about, for about 2 weeks, not even. I wasn't even taking them every day. And I'm still feeling severe symptoms of withdrawal. So imagine if you are following the prescription, which was for one every 4 hours, I would be in a world of hurt right now. And I'm somebody that absolutely doesn't have an addictive personality.
Yeah.
I'm somebody that got himself off the opiates cold turkey last time, which I do not suggest is extremely dangerous. Do not repeat this. But it just blows my mind every single time. So this time around, they were more sensible to it. And the pain management people seem to have a better grasp on, listen, this is serious business. And, you know, but still, prescribe them, and have fun, you know?
Well, and you asked for it. Again, your mindfulness is probably a 10 out of 10, as is your mental strength. You know, I look at myself and I look at you. I'm like the everyman, and you're like the guy. Like, again, I look at you like you're a G.I. Joe. That's how I look at you. Most people are the everyman when they come into this, and the lack of knowledge, the ignorance we bring into it, and we have no idea. Like, you walk in now and you, okay, this is a monumental surgery that I'm having. I accept the idea that opiates are going to be part of my managing, you know, the after effects of this and how I'm feeling. But hey, doc, help me make sure we manage this together. How many people don't come in with the forethought to even say that and know that, with the experience of getting off them, you know, cold turkey? It doesn't surprise me at all. You are the guy, you know, the David Goggins guys of the world or whatever, who would just go cold turkey off of these things. But boy, I can see why it's such a crisis. I really want to go down the path with you, Seb, talking a little bit about the anxiety, because I know I can relate. I was a guy who kind of grew up, for the most part, and it's not like it all came easy, but manifesting things and moving down the path that I wanted to, and envisioning things and doors opening and all of that kind of stuff kind of just happened. And I never really, I mean, I grew up with a dad with anger, and as a kid, I kind of learned how to negotiate my way around those things or whatever. But anxiety, when it hits you, and I've had it hit me fairly recently, a little bit, and maybe I'll talk about that more in a future episode because I'm still trying to unravel that. When you're somebody who has never dealt with anxiety and suddenly anxiety is there, boy, does it ever open up areas of empathy and other types of feelings that are new. What's it been like for you, being you, knowing your level of experience, to be facing anxiety?
Yeah. You know, to say that I haven't faced it is inaccurate, and maybe I portray this differently. I mean, I obviously have experienced it, but it's not something that's sort of overbearing in my life, right?
Yes.
And I do believe that, reasonably speaking, I'm able to logically override the things that are making me anxious. And I do that by going into exploration, right? So for example, if I'm anxious about something, instead of sitting back and letting it fester, I will face it head on. You know, I like the analogy where bisons will turn into the storm and go forward instead of waiting for it to pass.
Right.
And so, and going into exploration is the best way to stifle anxiety. But when you do that and it's still strong, it changes things. It changes the game a little bit, and it can affect your self-confidence. It can do a variety of different things. But so for me, there's a bit of a compounding issue here, which is, if I'm anxious, I'm nervous, and I have the sort of the body type that will start eating itself up. You know, like, for example, I generally walk around at, say, 210. Now, never mind the leg. You know, the leg is probably taking 5 or 6 pounds off of that. I'm not jumping on a scale right now. I can't stand on one anyways.
Not till next week.
but what I am seeing right now, even looking in the mirror, is I am dropping weight. you know, dramatically.
Yeah.
And that is an indication to me that I'm having a psychosomatic reaction to my withdrawals or to my anxiety,
yeah.
which I, you know, I can contend with because I know it's a temporary state of affairs, but just imagine having this as a regular way of life, so to speak, you know?
One of the ways to deal with the anxiety is to know that it's temporary, right? But most people who, like, again, you talk about the storm. I love the storm analogy and the bison going into the storm. I love that analogy because most people, logically, the reaction is, oh, I don't like this, so I want to get away from it. I want to mm-hmm. avoid it. But what they don't necessarily realize is the avoidance behavior, what it does is create a situation when the anxiety comes back, when the storm does come back, it's actually worse. And that incrementally gets worse and worse and worse over time. And at some point, you're going to deal with it. And whether it's your biological state, you know, you're having a heart attack or whatever, if you don't learn to deal with stress, anxiety, some of these things, it can really amplify later on. And the way that you deal with it, one of the ways to deal with it is to kind of is to tell yourself it's temporary. Do you have any other kind of quick tools, the way that you logically deal with things that people might be able to glean off of?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a major Pandora's box, right? Because we are yep. what we are talking about here is survivability, and we are built for one thing, and that's survival of the species. And mm-hmm. and as a result of that, every time that something scares us, we go into self-protection mode.
Yep.
We go, and then the reason why that is essentially we're magnifying the risk. We're spotlighting, so to speak, right? So we're spotlighting whatever it is that we are concerned with,
yep.
and the body goes, wait a minute, you weren't nervous or you weren't scared 5 minutes ago. Why are you scared now? Has mm-hmm. anything changed? Is there mm-hmm. something deadly? You know, stay away from that. And so, but we also know that comfort is where growth goes to die. So how do we reconcile those two? You know, well, it's essentially, I look at it this way, and this is kind of my process. I'm not suggesting it works for everybody, but mm-hmm. I'm generally logically overriding this simply because I understand that I am magnifying. Right. So therefore, it loses a bit of its power because mm-hmm. I logically override this by saying I'm magnifying. This isn't reality. And the mm-hmm. best way to exemplify this is, say, for example, you have a paper to write for school mm-hmm. or anything that has to be done. You'll generally spend more time fretting about not doing it. And when you are doing it, you'll say it wasn't that bad after all. Well, mm-hmm. the reason why it wasn't that bad after all is because you magnified how bad it was going to be.
Yes.
And now once you've gone into exploration and you've put pen to paper, you realize that, you know, it wasn't that bad after all. So next time it happens, just remember that and do it right away. So that way you don't carry the lingering anxiety that's associated with whatever it is that you need to do. Yeah. Additionally, engaging in uncomfortable things on the regular and you hear this all the time. It's almost on every t-shirt, but a lot of people don't understand how it works. Adversity will never stop coming in life. And
yep.
so I take every adversity piece, every small, the smallest of adversity as a rehearsal for the day where I have something, you know, that's truly adversarial or
yes.
something that's truly meaningful or something
yes.
that's truly, that puts me in a really dark place.
Yep.
Now, people are going through life trying to avoid pain, trying to avoid comfort, but we know that it's coming. There is no avoiding it. So it's better. Imagine if your favorite sports team didn't practice
yeah.
and they only went in game. So imagine adversity being game time and you haven't done any practices along the way.
Mm-hmm.
How do you expect and how do you reasonably expect yourself to step up for yourself when the going gets really hard if you stayed away from discomfort the mm-hmm. entire time? The answer is it doesn't work
yep.
at all. It doesn't. And so you're better to manage small things and implement your mechanisms with things that are less serious and egregious. And eventually, once you hit the real big stuff, you have practiced.
Yeah.
Your central nervous system is calmer because you've been there before. You've
yeah.
pushed yourself to certain limits. You've done certain things that are difficult that you didn't want to do.
Yeah.
There isn't a single day that I do not engage in something I don't want to do.
I think I've said it a lot. I'm a big Rogan fan, and Joe Rogan, you know, I mean, he's the biggest broadcaster in the world. He has this massive audience. And I mean, you know, he'll do a 3-hour podcast and he'll have literally 110 text messages that he just needs to catch up with his real life. You know, you get that busy and that big mm-hmm. people who, you know, and love are just, there's that many people who are just kind of grabbing at you and whatnot. And one of the things that he has said that he does to stay grounded is he's got his cold plunge. He's got his, you know, and then the inverse, he's got his sauna that he goes into and some of these things. You do things that stretch your body, that stretch yourself, that make you uncomfortable, because those are the things that make the little things in life that much more manageable. That makes so much sense that you're saying this. This process that you've gone through, you've lost your leg below the knee, you know, some opiates, some anxiety, things like that. Have you, and clearly you're the guy that does look into the storm. You're extremely mentally tough. Have you learned anything recently from this experience? Have you discovered any new truths?
It's really difficult to go for a whiz at night on one leg, especially in the dark.
Well, time to problem solve.
Wait, is that oversharing?
No. I love that you're able to take this attitude towards it. And I said that to you beforehand. I know I coming into this, I knew what your attitude was. You know, seeing your boys around you in the hospital bed, you're all joking and you're laughing and all of that stuff. A lot of people, and no pun intended, would lose a step or two mentally going through something like this. It doesn't feel like you have. Did you just, like, pre-surgery, because how long are we after? We're 2 weeks after, 3 weeks? I don't know if it's a few months.
A month after.
It's a month after right now. Okay. Did you go into it kind of already having accepted it, already deciding to have the attitude of humor towards it, no fear, or managed fear, I guess is probably a more accurate statement. Did you decide that beforehand? And, you know, is it just getting easier now?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in 2021, when this initially happened, on my third surgery, I asked the doctor, can we cut this thing off and put a prosthetic on there? And he looked at me like I had, you know, a third arm in my forehead.
Wow.
And the bottom line is I had made that call and I knew that it was a likely outcome based on the severity of what I had suffered.
Yeah.
And he made the right call by preventing me from doing that. And I'll explain why. We needed time to see if we could optimize that recovery, if there was a way to salvage the leg, if there was a way for me to recover. And had I not done that, it's easy now in hindsight for me to say I knew what needed to be done. But had I not done it, how would have I known? And now you start questioning. Say, for example, I do an amputation and I start experiencing complications. And now out of the complications, we now go mid-thigh, right? Yeah. So now I look back and I go, have I done everything I could to maximize the potential for recovery? And if the answer is no, because I was too in a rush to do things, then it becomes my burden. It becomes my fault, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And so in doing what the doctor suggested in this case, it was very beneficial because I was able to go 2 years, realize I had chronic pains every day, and there really was no change to my functionality level. And so at the end of the day, when I made the decision to do an elective amputation, very recently, I was 100% at peace with that. Whereas I would potentially have been, you know, questioning that had it not been the case. And so by the time we made a decision to electively amputate, I was good to go. There was no issues in my mind. I was prepared. But I will say this, there's a variety of things that need to happen when you make a decision of that sort of magnitude. Yeah. And that is to be educated on what it is that you are asking. What are the potential ramifications of it? How best to go about it in light of your circumstances and all of those things? And if you're hoping for a doctor to come and sweep in with a cape and save the day, you got it completely wrong. Yeah. You need to take ownership of that process, as you will eventually have to take ownership of your recovery. And so for me, I was so armed with the right information, and I'm not talking about Facebook research, I'm talking about medical journals and those types of things that I really dove into to try to see. And you know what? To a certain extent, it doesn't have to be medical journals. Right now, the information is everywhere. YouTube, you know, medical channels, those types of things where you can see videos, you can see explanations, you can
anecdotes of people who've been through it before. And
absolutely. And so I can tell you this. So the first surgeon I saw said something to me. Within 5 minutes of seeing me, she was prepared to amputate me mid-thigh. And I questioned that immediately. And she said, well, and I could see she was wishy-washy. So I'm like, okay, if she's wishy-washy, we're not having this conversation because this is a big gamble. Yep. Having somebody that's wishy-washy that doesn't really know. And so I suggested a certain course of action to her as a result of having done the research. Mm-hmm. She agreed to a certain extent and ended up referring me to another surgeon. Now, listen to this. This is gold right here. This is serendipity right here, or synchronicity, something. So, you know, for somebody that spent a lifetime in tactical operations, a lot of those doctors didn't understand what I was asking for, because for them, oh, you can walk, you're okay.
Right.
But I needed more. And so when she questioned why I was wanting to do it and all of those things, it fed into something that I wasn't keen about, which was her attitude towards my request, so to speak, and our ability to work together to make something work. And so when she recommended another doctor, I was really concerned, because I was generally high flyers recommend high flyers, and the opposite sometimes, you know, yep. Not so much.
Yep.
And so I was recommended a doctor by the name of Paul Hindles, and shout out to him as stud. So I get in my car, I start researching this guy. It turns out he's one of the best surgeons in the UK, now lives in Canada. Mm-hmm. He's done, I don't know if you're familiar with Mark Ormerod.
I'm not.
Mark Ormerod is the first triple amputee Royal Marines guys from the UK, the first triple amputee. He's a motivational speaker, a great guy. Oh. And he's over in the UK. You know, we did some guest speaking appearances together, all this stuff. Nice. Great guy. Well, it was Mark Ormerod's surgeon. And so he comes to Canada. He's here on a temporary basis. He's a former special operations surgeon. He's done hundreds of those interventions on people like me.
Yeah.
And so when I showed up in his office, within 2 minutes, we were gelling. We were having a blast. He was totally understanding what I was wanting. Mm-hmm. And he agreed with it. And he did a fantastic job on the slim. He made it 10 times nicer looking than I expected it to be. He yep. made it more functional. He did all of those things. And so for me, if I have one piece of advice to give, you need to be your own advocate and you need to be educated. Do not rely on the fact that somebody has a PhD in front of their names to do the work for you. Just like when you go to the barber, they yep. may not be as invested in making that beard look as nice as you want it
yep.
if you did it yourself. And so yep. sometimes corners are being cut. And so, and willfully or not, I'm not accusing anybody or anything.
No.
What I am saying is you need to be your own self-advocate. And there's been so many times within the context of my medical journey where that's proven to be critically important.
Well, and you take, you make a really good point, and sometimes it takes an event of this magnitude in life, but I do believe that we live in such a society of comfort now, and we've got blinders on thinking it could never happen to us. You look at what's going on geopolitically in the world and whatever, and there's a generation of people, probably myself included, you know, I still live my childhood in so many ways, but at the same time, we have these blinders on saying, oh, it will never happen because of the level of comfort that I've been able to grow up in, really one of the only generations in history that's ever been able to grow up in this kind of a place. And there are so many people when they live their life, they're in the co-pilot seat. They're not in the pilot seat of their life, but they're in the co-pilot seat. And not only that, the autopilot's on, and they think, okay, well, this happens to me. Okay. Like you say, I got a doctor who will just do this. There's automatic processes. But the moment you have an epic event like this, for us, for me, actually, it was the first time my wife got sick. And I think I've talked about that on here before. She had Lyme disease, you know, and I had to become her advocate. And I didn't know what that was like, because there was times where she was paralyzed in the hospital, and it was a Lyme thing. But our medical system doesn't recognize Lyme the way that other places do in the world. And so they were calling it other things. And they were like, we had a neurologist say to her, oh, this is psychogenic. It's in your head. And you know, there are so many people that just accept that because they are in the co-pilot seat and they listen to what that person who, you know, is probably doing the best that they can in what they know. But like you said, not 100% invested in the situation, maybe familiar with whatever, you're not vibing at that same level, and learning how to become an advocate, you know, and then. You know, 3 months later, we got referred to another doctor who's also a naturopath who sent Candy's blood work off to Germany. And they looked at it through the lens that they look through things. And suddenly, it's not psychogenic. It's not the beginning forms of MS. And within 2 or 3 weeks, Candy's driving again. Candy's walking again. She's doing, and she's better. And she's gotten better. And if we weren't advocates, if I didn't learn how to be an advocate for her, you know, if we would have just been in that co-pilot seat, it would be a different life 10 years later or 8 years later, whatever it is for us, than it is now. Our granddaughter, when she was in for BC Children's Hospital for cancer, we were her advocate. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it right now for my dad who's starting to go into dementia. And you talk about not just cruising along through life in that co-pilot seat and living it. Okay, you've got your hands on the yoke of life, and every little turn that you make makes things adjust. And that's where you got to be, at least in certain areas of your life, if you want to live, be more fulfilled. You got to be present. You got to be able to do that. And this is a great example of how you did that, how you were your advocate. So thank you for this message. I think a lot of people need to hear that. There's a lot of people. Hey, everybody out there, where are you at right now? Are you in the pilot seat or are you in the co-pilot seat? It's a good check to do. Get present and figure out, get mindful. Great, great message on that. I appreciate it. Is the healing going well?
Yeah, it's going really well. And just before I move on, like something you said triggered something in me, but when we talk about being in the,
we do that for each other. We don't
do,
we
do.
I love that.
you know, when you talk about being in a passenger seat, I use that analogy a lot for people that are in victimhood, right?
For sure.
Because if you're in victimhood, you have no control over life at all. So you are better to take ownership of things that, yes, are impacted by external factors, but if you take ownership of everything in your life, it's so empowering, and you are in a driver's seat. You can take this wherever you want. But mm-hmm. if you're in the passenger seat with no driver, you're at the mercy of everybody who decides to wrong you, yep. you know?
Yes.
And along the way, or circumstances, or whatever yep. the case may be.
Yep.
And so being in that driver's seat is a critical piece of this. Now, let's talk about the recovery, right? Because yes, my recovery is going very well, but here's how I took recovery. This is a battle. I'm going to do 5 hours of work a day, engaging in the process, not I'm going to go recover by staying home, waiting for my leg to be better. I can't work out. I can't do this. I can't do that. Dude, I was working out on day 2 post-surgery mm-hmm. with a little hand exerciser, right? And next thing I know, on very short order, I'm in the hyperbaric chamber. I'm in the multibaric chamber. I'm on red light therapy. I'm doing biochargers. I'm out in the woods and connecting with nature. Mm-hmm. I'm doing cold plunges, using the sauna, the steam room, all of those things as soon as my wound was shut and I was able to. And I was back in the gym within 2 weeks post-surgery. If you don't do those things, and if you do not engage in your recovery, you will not optimize your recovery.
Yep.
The only reason why I'm 4 weeks ahead of schedule right now is because we thoroughly engaged in this. And this is, you know, a credit to a lot of people that helped me, you know, within that process. But the point I'm making is, again, in the driver's seat, you go, how do I maximize this recovery? Is this going to be a case of me lying in bed waiting to recover? Or am I going to be actively participating in this and seeking the things that I need to do that can help me? And that is also multidimensional. Mm-hmm. Multidimensional, sound bath, you know, name it. I did all of this stuff. All of this sort of holistic approach to making the body and the mind and the soul better at the same time. We tend, as human beings, we tend to silo things.
Yes.
We do not like complexities. And so what we do is we simplify life. We mm-hmm. simplify everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wrong because everything is so deeply interconnected and interwoven that in order to maximize anything, you need to treat everything like everything matters, you know, within yes. the context of your life. And yes. so this is another piece of advice I have for everybody. Make yourself, if you are going through something medically or otherwise, make yourself a schedule, get working, find the resources, you know, get engaged in this. If you can't work out for X, Y, and Z, can you do something with your hands? Can you do something with your head? Can you start mm-hmm. studying a new language? What else can you do to keep yourself sane? You know, all of those things, especially if you're somebody that's generally defined by, say, a higher level of physical fitness, and now you're unable to do the things that you would love to do. Mm-hmm. You can engage in so many other things, and you're going to develop in areas of your life where you would have never invested time before because you were too busy doing the things that you know, kick butt at, so
yep.
to speak.
Yep. Yeah, you're in your normal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Multi-dimensions,
so,
man.
So here's a question now. Have any new goals that mm-hmm. wouldn't have ever been on your radar before? Have any new goals showed up for you now that you are made up the way that you are?
Well, the beauty with losing a limb like this is you essentially start everywhere.
Yeah.
You know? And so if I look at myself, for example, I'm a jiu-jitsu black belt. Well,
yeah.
am I you know, now I got a leg missing. So my game, which is generally applied in a certain way, now needs to change.
Yep.
Right. And also, I'd said for years now, I was wanting to work on my hands. Well, guess what? Now is the opportunity. Once I have my prosthetic, I can start boxing because I haven't done boxing in a while.
Yep.
Right. Those types of things. But then as far as on the spiritual sense or on the academic sense, for example, which is something that was on the back burner during my operational career, well, I just wrapped up a master's. But now I got time. So maybe I will jump into a PhD. Why not? Right. And so the idea. It isn't, and I don't care about the PhD. I don't care about the title. I don't care about any of this. I care about bettering myself. I care about developing. I care about continuing to grow, all of those things. And so there, when something like this happened, I see it as an opportunity to tie in a white belt in all these different areas. Man, that is a golden opportunity, an opportunity only afforded to those that live.
Oh my gosh. Is it an affliction or is it an opportunity? What a fantastic way to look at it. And we can look at that in our life, no matter what it is that we're going through.
Absolutely.
And again, this isn't taking away the impact of whatever people are going through. There are people that are going through massive things, whatever it is, whether it's the judgment of it. There is no judgment of it. If you're going through something, trauma is trauma, whatever that looks like, adversity is adversity, but is it, Can you take it, and how can you take it and turn it into an opportunity? What a great message that is. Would you? I want you to get a PhD so I can call you Dr. Sebbender. I'm going to do that. But what did you finish your master's in?
International security, global counterterrorism.
Of course. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to pick your brain a little bit about that now with current events and things that are happening and all of that stuff. You must have some very unique opinions on that. Can you go all the way? Can you become Dr. Seb in that area? Or do you know if you ever did a PhD, would it be in something similar?
Yeah. So I'm still debating is the answer. So one of the things that my master's revealed to me is that we're very limited on what we can do on account of the information that we are provided.
Okay.
And I mean, you know, from state actors, et cetera. So it's kind of difficult. It's a good degree to have in international security, especially for me that travels overseas, work into war zones, do all of those things. And it's an extra little feather in the hat in relation to my operational career, which was quite diverse. But at the same time, I wasn't very from an academic standpoint, I wasn't that strong at the time.
You were an operations guy.
Yeah, I was very, very much so. So now I feel like I have a better blend of the two, which I think is critical. But I considered doing a PhD in international security, which I'm not sure where that leads me and if I'm interested in it. Mm-hmm. One field I've been extremely, invested in over the course of my entire life is psychology. Mm-hmm. And recently I had a meeting with the head of psychology of a university, which for the moment shall remain unnamed.
Okay.
And we had an hour conversation. And at the end of the conversation, she said to me, you would absolutely fit in right into our PhD of psychology without a previous bachelor or master's of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not she was telling me this to get the money, or she was truthful in her assessment, she seemed genuine, and she seemed to believe that this is something I could definitely do. And so I've been considering doing a doctorate of psychology instead of going into and having a master's of international security, a doctorate in psychology. And so again, this is a big decision. It's, 4-year degree through research. It's a lot of work. So I just want to make sure that if I set up to do it, there is no stopping me. And so I got to make sure that the circumstances are right. But definitely it could be one of the two.
And you talk about already, I look at you and again, as somebody who watches what you're doing and enjoys, I love having dialogue with you. You seemed already so well-rounded in so many ways because how well-spoken you are and how maybe anecdotally educated that you are, but the fact that you might add this to your
repertoire,
your toolbox, your toolbox. that is what a cool thing. Would you want to take that and use it for, like to me, that's a guy who goes to work for like the military in a very high, cool position, or this, like, if it's, you're in the US, the CIA or something like that, the NSA, that kind of thing. Do you want to go into service when it comes to that sort of stuff that you love so much, or the police, you know, that kind of thing? Or do you want to be more, I want to help joke you public more, that kind of a thing? Where are you leaning these days, Seb?
Yeah, there is a very slight chance that I would re-engage in a career that's very similar to the career I had before. And simply because I left for a reason. Yeah. I left for the reason of expanding my horizons, of wearing additional lenses to view the world by. And I certainly going for government organizations and being institutionalized again and doing all of those things and facing the same hurdles and those types of frustrations and everything. I'm more about managing the amount of negative emotions I let in my life now. And one of the things that really helps me is to help others.
Yeah.
And not necessarily as a therapist or anything like that, but I'm doing performance coaching right now. I'm taking people from this level, bringing them up here. And I love that. But I want to do other things. Quite frankly, I want to travel. I would love to have an opportunity to draw money from various sources of income so that I can travel the world. I can go to Iceland. I can engage in life. My goal right now at 46 years old, after 23 years of combined service between the military and police, is to live life.
Right.
And yes, we need money to live. That's a fact.
Absolutely.
And so having the ability to do virtual work, having the ability to do guest speaking engagements, to write books, to present, to do whatever, all of those things, you know, not necessarily in that order, is a massive, very appealing proposition for me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very reluctant to engage, and I've been offered lots of things.
Well, I can imagine you have.
And I'm very reluctant to re-engage in that as I perceive it as a step backwards.
Right. It's more, it's into the structure, into the old, into the system. Now, that being said, with everything going on in the world right now, I geopolitically, all that stuff, but also just mindset, people's mindsets towards, you know, what security is, you know, whether it's your local police all the way up to, you know, the highest levels. We live in such an interesting time right now with all the polarization and division that's happening. How do you reconcile that? Can you see both sides of things? Can you see the argument on both sides? You seem like to be the guy who is pretty well balanced and can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm generally quite moderate. And the reason why that is this is generally where critical analysis comes into play, right? Yeah. And so for me, and I'm also very stoic, so I do not look at things from an emotional standpoint. I will recognize emotions, I will acknowledge emotions, and I will put them aside on account of, you know, doing the work and figuring out exactly what is going on. So instead of how do I feel about this, what is this, before I start injecting all I feel about it, you know? Yeah. And so I do believe that we live in an overly emotional world. And what I mean that is people let their emotion drive the bus. They let their emotions. And that's the reason why we're so divided. It's like everybody's losing their minds when it comes to anything. And we're volatile and explosive. And we simply don't seem to be able to conduct critical analysis because of our own inherent biases. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's all about maintaining that homeostasis. And that's not to say that I, you know, don't engage one way or another, because that's another place where you don't want to be like no man's land and never making a decision on anything.
Yeah. Or yeah, never. You can't be lukewarm. You have to.
Exactly. So, but I do believe that controlling our emotions as a collective is going to be critical. Let's call a spade here. In the current landscape, and this is my opinion and my opinion only.
Sure.
In the current landscape and the way things are going and how we're divided and all of those things, you know, the next mass extinction isn't going to be coming from the external factors.
No.
We're going to take care of that ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and if you can't feel the heat rising at right now, you are not paying attention.
Yep.
Like the heat is rising, and that's everywhere. And so the what we need for this to come to fruition is for all of us to fall apart. And if everybody falls apart, we no longer work together, we no longer care about our neighbors, we no longer maintain our humanity, we no longer connect with each other, all of those things are going to be massive contributor to making a catastrophic event happen, right? And whatever that looks like.
Yep.
And so we, as a collective, as humanity, we need to dial it down a lot. And we need to set emotions aside and start having a critical look at some of the things that we are doing. Stop taking sides, jumping on bandwagon that you don't understand anything about, and just waving flags that you don't know anything about. And don't pretend that because you have an emotional reaction to a situation that you are correct.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's until we can safely do that and use poise and stoicism in looking at the world and our current situation and how we interact with each other, we are going to have some severe issues.
Could not agree more. When did you get into stoicism?
I've always been like that. So this is long before this became popular on Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, because it's a thing. Stoicism is a movement now.
Listen, you know, a little anecdote for you because I know you like them. 2 days ago, you're familiar with the Dokudo, the book of Miyamoto Musashi. So a couple of days ago, so I read the Book of Five Rings and I read a lot of his quotes and things over the years. And I always agreed with him because same sort of mentality, not comparing myself to Musashi by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
Especially not in a sword fight.
but appreciating it though. And I love the story. I love it's a fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was listening to a brief sort of YouTube video on the 21 rules of the Dokudo, and Musashi speaking about, and every single one of those rules without a single exception I've applied to my entire life.
Really?
Without a single exception. Yeah. So and this is, I have not studied it.
Wow.
I have not done any, you know, this has just been something that's seemingly comes natural to me through obviously lots of adversity and all of those things. But my personality is very stoic without even sort of knowing or understanding necessarily. And so one of the things that's interesting is people misread, or in the context of stoicism as we know it by now, where people are actually reading about it and everything, is a lack of emotion. Stoicism isn't a lack of emotion. Stoicism is a recognition that the emotions are there, set them aside and take the wheel, because you can't let your emotion take the wheel. And the way I exemplified this when I teach, say, leadership courses, those types of things, is I ask people, who here makes better decision when they're super angry or super happy? No
That's
hands
an easy
come up.
Question. It's an easy question to ask. It's an easy question to accept and be real about.
100%. And so most of the people, as you might expect, don't raise their hand because they know if I'm super excited, I'll make a stupid decision. If I'm angry, I'll make a stupid decision. Okay. So now we just acknowledge that all of the ways that people are reacting right now, say to the current landscape, to the political situations, to the world, you know, geopolitical situations, all of those things are inherently based into very, very destructive emotions. And so how do we reconcile that? Well, we don't. We need to control our emotions. That's what we need to do.
It's funny. I'll trade anecdotes with you. So, and this one you'll like. So I've got a 5-year-old granddaughter. We talked about her, you know, went to children's hospital with her. She's went through cancer. She's amazing, amazing little survivor. She's 5 now. And she went through that at 18 months. And I believe that experience, without her knowing it, helped her become this amazing survivor. So she turns 4 years old. She's already kind of declared cancer free. We're so happy about that. We put her into MMA. And the MMA class that we put her into is taught by a guy by the name of David Lee. He's been a guest on this show before. David Lee is a world-class MMA coach, locally here in Kelowna, British Columbia. Shout out to David Lee. And he's put like 4 or 5 people in the UFC, including he's Rory McDonald's coach. Yeah, absolutely. And so, but then they also have their little junior samurai program. And I take Alara to MMA twice a week, and watching these little 5-year-olds learn jiu-jitsu and striking and all of this sort of stuff. He gives them a life lesson before every class. It's amazing. Now, when you watch them running around before class, one day I came in there, and Dave's a guy who I consider a friend, and I was there early, and there was just a couple kids running around. He said, "How you doing?" I said, I'm okay. I'm feeling a little anxiety right now. It's about 6 months ago. And Dave's a guy who believes in, he's a very stoic guy as well. And I can just share that with him. I love the guys in my life who, if I'm going through something and I'm not feeling myself and I'm present knowing that, instead of just burying it back, I'm the guy that will tell those safe people, "I'm kind of going through some stuff right now. I'm feeling the pressure of life right now." And Dave's like, yeah, I hear you, man. I'm sorry about that. That sucks and whatnot. And I say to him, I say, what's your secret? And he goes, I'm very stoic. He goes, I zoom out. And I realize that we're on a hunk of rock that's flying 55,000 miles, whatever it is, through space. And at any time, anything can happen. And we're here for a very, very short time. Like, it just totally reframes where you're at. And if you zoom out the situation that you're in right now, you realize how everything is temporary and nothing is promised. And I think that that might be the key right there. There are people, I've watched some people in the Ukraine, and I'm not taking a position on anything. I've watched accounts of people from the Ukraine talking about how they've lived a life without knowing war to a time where they know war. And how right now, because of the uncertainty of life, life is more rich to them.
100%.
And I've seen them say that, and it's amazing to me. I don't want to be over there. I think about my granddaughter. I don't want her to know that stuff. But at the same time, I also don't want to be so filtered that I'm literally just going through the motions of life. And I think many times when I feel anxiety, part of it is the fact that I am just feeling the motions of life, kind of what we were saying before. And when you zoom out and realize that everything is temporary, it could all end in a second. It reframes things. And that's something David said to me a couple months ago.
I think it's great. I mean, he's using detachment is what he's doing, right?
Yeah.
Detaching from the situation, having a critical look, almost like a bird's eye view.
Yep.
But you know what's interesting with parenting, for example, and I think we might have spoken about this the first time, I can't remember for sure.
Yeah.
But parents, and if we look at it, helicopter parenting, for example, or if we're looking at raising our kids, a lot of people are doing all they can to remove adversity from the kid's life.
Yep.
And I always ask them, I go, you're a pretty squared away person. They're like, yep. I'm like, did you face a lot of adversity? Oh, absolutely, I did. Okay, so now you want to take all the adversity off your kids, right? Because that's going to turn out exactly like you wanted to.
Yep.
No, it's not going to. You're going to make him weak is what you're going to do. And so I'm not suggesting that you let them get beatings and those types of things, because that was never acceptable, should have never been left, you know, to their own demise in this case. But I like to call it adversity monitoring.
Yep.
I monitor the adversity that they're under, and I will let them negotiate until I realize that it's too much, right?
Yep.
And then I will step in. But I think that the concept of trying to make our kids' life so comfortable that they don't have to work for anything that we had is going to do exactly the opposite of what we wanted to.
Yes.
And I was teaching a course in Haiti, and this is a pretty cool story. I was teaching a course in Haiti, and Haiti, I don't know if you know this, but 10,000 cases of cholera in the last 2 years, deaths, major, major gang problems, you know, with armed gangs. We're talking about, you know, wide open air gang rapes. We're talking about violence, nobody's business.
This is real adversity, real extreme stuff.
We are talking about a place that is collapsing on itself at the moment.
Real danger.
It's extremely, extremely, within 10 minutes of landing, automatic gunfire everywhere.
Yep.
Okay. So I was having this conversation with some of the people I was teaching, and I was talking about suicide, and they asked me what suicide was all about. Why would anyone do that? Right. And so I said, okay, I took a tactical pause and I looked at myself and I said, they either there's such a stigma around it that they refuse to speak about it, or they are privileged and, you know, really not exposed to anything. So I was able to discount all of this, and I went and I did a bit of research to find out what the statistics were. And it turns out that their suicide rates were 7% lower than in Canada.
Yeah.
However, and people might say, well, 7%. 7% is a massive drop in suicide rate for a country that has nothing, right? And so it became quite clear to me. Now, let's tie this into an experience I've had myself recently since retiring from the force. So I spent 12 years in, well, actually 16 years in tactical operation, okay? Where every time I went on a call, every time I entered a house, every time I did anything, the prospect of me facing a hail, a bullet, or something was real, and it was there. And I accepted that. The acceptance of death was a part of my job. I did it for a strong purpose, and it was really rooted in this.
Yeah.
And so all of the other fears, you know, flying and doing this and going, you know, in the dark, or having fear of interpersonal violence or whatever those things,
perspective.
never it never afflicted me as a grown man. Okay. So listen to this. This is where it gets interesting. So I retired from the team four years ago now, or maybe five. Yeah. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. Very bad with time. And so recently I started noticing that I was getting fear back in some of these little instances. Like I would go out on a trip. I've been on 1,100 flights because I was in a tactical unit that work in airplanes.
Yeah.
So I was proceeding through life without ever caring about that. But all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm flying. Now, you know what happened to me? I got comfortable. You know what happens when you get comfortable? You get soft.
Yeah.
Here's the secret. That happens. I know for a fact that all of those things were not even, didn't even register a bleep on the radar when I was an active operator, because the risk I was facing daily was 10 times greater than that. When the pandemic hit, I was the safest I'd ever been because I had just retired from the team. Everybody else was losing their minds, right? Yeah. And so the point I'm making here is comfort is not our friend. Comfort is not beneficial for us at all, even though we like it and we seek it and we seek to sort of supplement it with pleasure hormones, dopamine and oxytocin and all of those things. And the more pleasure we feel and seek, the weaker we get. And so it's a fine balance to do the things that we want to do that are enriching for us, that are gratifying for us, that bring us fulfillment and meaning, but also we ought to have the other side to balance it out. Because if we don't do that, we're going to get soft in a real hurry. And that's what's happening in the Western world.
Yeah, very much so. Mm-hmm. And you look at people who don't have this perspective, who are loud voices, speaking, with ignorance. And I'm not trying to be a jerk and saying ignorance. I'm saying they don't have that knowledge. They don't have this perspective that you're talking about. Yeah. To go back to the parenting thing for a second. I mean, if you say to any parent, do you want your kid to have a better life than you did? And the answer is, of course, a universal yes. But I think assumptions come with that, especially the autopilot assumptions are, okay, yeah, I want them to have comfort or be soft or wealthy or whatever it is. No. I want them to have a better life than me. So I am going to give them, this level of comfort where I don't have to put any work in and deal with it. Instead, I could pour into my kids and put these skills in or allow them to put these skills in and allow them what you're talking about, allow them to experience making decisions that cause this, growth, this perspective that you're talking about, put them in situations where they're wrestling a kid who's 2 years older than them. What are they going to do about it? It's a controlled situation, but now they're stretching themselves, way more than the average kid. I mean, we're just using the MMA example or whatever, but having a better life than what you had means giving them the opportunity to deal with life better than what you had. It doesn't mean money. It doesn't mean comfort. It means more skills in that regard, the way that I see it. But again, I think people, when they like that platitude and they automatically kind of check the box saying, yeah, that's what I want for them, but they never explore what that means. And they're not proactive with that. And I think that's perspective that you're talking about is incredible. Everybody needs to see that. Like all these people who have these gigantic opinions, they're talking about the youth of San Francisco and people like this right now. You throw them into a third world country for 3 weeks and help them build a school for somebody or something like to do an act of service, because this is how other people live. It changes the perspective and they realize the level, the point of view they're coming from is a little bit askew compared to the rest of the real world.
I couldn't agree more. And we have gone to a point where we see perspective as invalidation. Oh, and that is a massive pet peeve of mine. It's like, well, no, perspective isn't invalidation. Invalidation is you using the perspective to invalidate. That's a different story.
Yes.
That is not what ought to happen. What ought to happen is for you to use perspective as a anchor, something, I'll give you an example of this. When the situation occurred with my leg 2 years ago, there was a day where I was self-pitying, and I'm admittedly, for the first day, I was self-pitying, and I'm allowing myself that because I know the next day it's all business, right? And so what happened is I'm lying there self-pitying and I get online and I'm like, let's seek some perspective. And I start looking at news and all this good stuff. And I see a young Marines that was in Afghanistan who walked on a landmine, and he lost four limbs. So 22-year-old stud, you know, in the beginning of his career,
yep.
Now is a torso, if effectively. I look down at my leg and I'm like, I'm good, you know?
Yeah.
And some people say, well, that's invalidating your own. It's like, no, it's not. That's perspective, mm-hmm. man. This guy has a positive attitude. Mm-hmm. And he, despite the severity of what he's going through, there is nothing to stop me from doing this at a lower level.
Yep.
Right. And then inversely, if I'm the guy that's the example, now I have a responsibility to be that guy for others. What does that speak of? That speak of purpose.
Yes.
You want to find a reason to be the person that you need to be in life. Find purpose.
Yes. I could not agree more with that. And I think we've talked about this. I think it was with you. Purpose comes up in almost every single HeCast because He Changed It was born because of, you know, Candace and her team doing the research where guys are at right now. Why is there this men's mental health crisis? And a huge part of it has to do with a lack of purpose. A huge part of it has to do with the fact that the blinders have been on and they're connecting that. I've used this phrase so many times. I'm sorry to the audience. Connecting the dots, you know, guys are doing what they've been told to do, what society told them to do, whatever, without having that thinking in color mindset, being fully present mindset. And they get to middle age and they're like, well, now what? And they've never kind of been pushed into that place of what is something that gives me purpose in life. And then whatever that looks like, you know, the dream of I want to be in the NHL. Okay, if you're in your 40s, you're not going to the NHL. Sorry, it's not going to happen. But you can play in a beer league. You can do something where you can scratch that itch for no outcome whatsoever, except for the fact that it's in your belly and you want to express it somehow. It could be through music. It could be through athletics. It could be through anything like that. It could be through education, like you say. But that purpose, that getting up off the couch, you know, instead of the receiving everything, entertain me, Nirvana, you know, talking about entertain us, you know, daring the establishment to entertain them, stop having that attitude and get a little proactive to figure out what your purpose is. And suddenly things start to get better. They just do. And we want to be a vehicle. I know He Changed It. I mean, it's in its infant stage right now. Again, if you haven't downloaded the app, please download the He Changed It app. It's in the infant stage right now. But one of the things that they want to add to it is some sort of vehicle inside there to help that trail of breadcrumbs begin, where men can go and they can start finding out what their purpose are. And it's not just men. She Changed It's coming. They Changed It is coming. All of this stuff is coming. I think humans just need to find that. And if we do that, it will also lead to empathy for others who are trying to find their purpose as well. Perspective differences are a good thing. They allow us to examine our thoughts, our beliefs. Or we can just tribal up and we can start fighting other people. Well, how about this? Think about it from their perspective and how might it change yours? And that's how we can kind of get out of this mess that we're in right now, because it is totally possible. And where the optimist in me comes out, because of this polarization that's there, what an opportunity for us to all come forward. You lost your leg. Opportunity. You could be the victim. You could let everything happen to you. You can listen to whatever doctor says that gets thrown there and not be your own advocate. Or you could use this opportunity, this epic event, to move forward and go, okay, I'm going to be present in this. Right now, our society is in a place where we all collectively have that opportunity, no matter what side we're on, to stand up and really, really examine every perspective and do that. And it could turn into a massive positive. And I'm hoping that that's what happens. And I hope that not too many eggs will need to be broken to make that omelet. But we have this opportunity to do that too. That's the other side of the coin. When shit like this is going on, massive opportunity.
Absolutely. And I think it starts with introspection. And it starts with understanding what we contribute to this game called life.
Yeah.
Because everybody's so externally focused. Why are you externally focused? Why are you focused on external validation?
Yeah.
Why are you focused on things that other people expect of you? Why are you focused on you know, all of those things? Look internally. What are you contributing? And ask the tough questions. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wants everybody else to do something about mental health.
Yes.
And everybody wants to have the conversation. That's cool, guys. I'm all for the conversations. But what actions are you personally taking to make it better?
Yes.
So I see, and this happens all the time in my business, in my performance coaching business, where people mm-hmm. approach me and they say, I've done everything I could. I've seen a psychiatrist. I've done this. I've done that. I've said, okay, how many times you went for a walk in nature last week? None. Exactly. How many times you go for a workout? None. What kind of nutritious food are you eating? Well, I'm not eating that great right now. Okay. Scratch. And at the end of the day, I'm telling them, listen, if you want to take control over that downward spiral and that tailspin you're in, you need to look at you and what you are doing and the actions that you are taking to make things better. This is not about making you, disregarding what you're going through or invalidating it or any of that. But once we agree that you're in a tough spot right now, what are we doing about it?
Yeah.
What are we doing? And if you haven't done any of those 10 things, you have not done everything you could at all. You're not even close. So that's why you're still in that spin. So we need to start actioning those items. We need to start teaching you what are the benefits. Now, it's not just their fault, because what needs to happen is we need to be able to articulate why those things are good for you.
Yes.
How does the concept of manifestation work? How does being uncomfortable works? And why is it beneficial to our brains?
Yep.
Why is engaging and connecting with nature so good for us from a mm-hmm. grounding perspective as humans? All of those things. If you don't have the knowledge, you can't make an informed decision. But here's where the kicker is. That knowledge, nobody is tasked with importing it upon you. You need to search it. You need to be engaged in that process.
Yep.
And if you speak to people that had severe cases of PTSD or occupational stress injuries and have sort of elevated, above that, so they still live with it, but they have made their lives 10 times better, they have done a ton of hard work.
Yes.
Nobody came to save them. Yes, there were people engaged along the way to provide guidance and do all those things. And that's totally normal.
Support doesn't mean they're doing it for you, but that also doesn't mean you're doing it alone.
Get yourself some battle buddies.
Those guys around you, around your gurney with your leg off, your boys around you, they're all there to support you while you do the hard work.
100%.
So you're doing it. You're not alone.
100%.
Yeah. But they're not doing it for you.
Surround yourself with savages and do the work. Right? Those are my two, key.
Yeah, it's the truth. And I like, okay, so you and I immediately, we just start talking and suddenly an hour is gone. It's like time travel is possible when I talk with you. I hate that we got to wrap it up. We're doing a couple more seasons of this, and I'm going to have you back on again and again. I can't wait to have you, in person and do stuff with you in person as He Changed It grows more and more and more. You're going to be a huge key in the He Changed It universe and community as we build this thing. And Candy and her team are just busting their butt to get it out of, startup is crazy, man. And it's you want to talk about the adversity and dealing with the adversity that my wife is, she's doing 75 hard at the same time while she's building this thing. And I'm so inspired by what they're doing right now. I'm so inspired by you. I appreciate you. What are ways that people can find you and follow you? And if somebody is inspired by what it is that you're doing, are you taking on like personal clients right now? What are some of the things that you're doing, and how can people reach out to you, Seb?
Yeah, absolutely. I found great reward and I find it very gratifying to help people through life. I don't like to call myself a life coach. I find that tacky, but I do like to be the person that has the ability to bring many different lenses to somebody's lives to help them optimize who they are. And yes, I do take clients on. And it's actually the best way for me to live, because I would love to go, travel to Mexico and have clients that I can virtually follow and help and mentor. And I have quite a few now, but I still have a lot of spots open. And so one of the best ways to reach me is through my Instagram, curiously enough. It seems as though everybody's reaching me on there. So I'm sure you're going to link it in there. But
it's worth watching, folks. Watch his Instagram. You'll be inspired just watching him.
Thanks,
like,
brother.
Like world class. Like I'm talking, like when you see a guy like David Goggins or Jocko or some of these other people, Seb is that's the level that Seb is. Watch his Instagram just to be inspired.
Much
by
appreciate
him.
That.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's your Instagram?
Yeah, so my Instagram is at @SLAVCCMDR. So at @SLAVCCMDR. That is my Instagram account. I do have a business website, which is Raven Strategic, spelt with a K.
Yeah.
So it's funny because my business name is actually spelt with a C, but I couldn't get the domain, so I got
it with
a K. So ravenstrategic.com is my website. And on there's all kinds of stuff, guys. And don't get limited by what it is that you are seeing on there, because there's I do a whole bunch of custom curriculums, all kinds of creative courses. Like, if there's something I can help with, I will tell you. And if I cannot help with it, I will not take your money. I will simply, you know, advise you to go somewhere else. I have all these contacts in other areas. I will gladly send you to somebody that's much more suited to help you instead of trying to make a buck and you know, not be the right person for you. But if I am the right person for you, hit me up. Like, we've had some incredible successes this year, and I am absolutely beyond stoked to be coaching people through life, essentially.
Yeah. And the inspiration that you are, just tangentially watching what it is that you do is amazing. I'm so glad that you're in our life, Seb, in our crosshairs. As we grow this thing, I know we're going to have you back sooner than later again. I just want to say thank you once again for being a part of HeCast, and we really appreciate you being around and being an example of a guy that, and I mean, you are a stereotypical, action hero guy, but the idea of you being able to kind of crack open your mentality and share it with others, really, really grateful that you're on this planet and that you're doing what you're doing. You're a light in this world, Seb. So thank you for being you.
Wow. Thank you so much, brother. And same to you guys and your team of savages that's working tirelessly to make this happen.
Oh, thank you so much. It's not easy, but it's worth it. Candy and the team, when they hear that sort of stuff, you know, when they're hearing the podcast, when it comes out and whatnot, that stuff helps like crazy. Because again, building a startup like this, one of the mentors that Candy had early on, he looked at her and he said, well, what you want to do is not low hanging fruit, but the orchards are full. And it hasn't been easy. It's been a 5-year journey. Hopefully we're about to see some real elevation here soon. And you're one of those guys that believed in us right from the start. So thank you so much, Seb. I appreciate it. This is why we do the show. Episodes like this just they Mike, you're already excited. Yeah, these make me excited even more. I just absolutely love this so much. If you haven't downloaded the HeChanged app yet, what the heck are you waiting for? Head on over to HeChanged.com, and whatever your technological persuasion is, the link to whichever version of the app is there, you can go ahead and download it. This has been another episode of HeCast, the official podcast of HeChanged It. My name is Mike Chisholm. Go change something.